You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Welcome back, friends. Please make sure your pod seats and tray tables are in their upright and locked positions. The airlock has been sealed and docking clamps have been released for an on-time departure to the Functional Nerdverse. So, Patrick.
Tracy.
You ever, like, had a weird coincidence or run-in with something where you're like, oh, this is terribly convenient. This is exactly the sort of thing that I need. Any recollections of an experience like that? Sort of handy kismet, as it were?
Probably.
Not off the top of my head, he says.
Not off the top of my head as I'm searching for the name of a pizza place in Phoenix and Sedona.
Yeah, and why, in fact, a Phoenix or Sedona-based pizza place is important will become evident shortly. But for me, listeners who have kind of had their eye on the ball of the podcast for a while are aware of the fact that my son's been in college now for the last semester, we were in his college town visiting his school for like a family day kind of weekend deal back at the end of October. And when we were doing that, we had some time we needed to kill before the next kind of on-campus event that we were interested in doing was going to be happening, which meant going to downtown. I should note that this is an extremely small Midwestern town with a very adorable downtown that, like many adorable Midwestern downtowns, is caught somewhere in the kind of like tilt point between falling apart and coming back. And it's sort of in the coming back swing right now. And they have a lovely little bookstore called Our Town Books. And so we happened into the bookstore, my two kids and my husband and I, and wouldn't you know, there was an author signing going on. And so I'm kind of a sucker for author signings, having done one or two of them before, and knowing that they are, just so fraught. Like, so fraught, the author signings. So I strolled on up and 5 minutes later was dropping email addresses with Laura K. Maurer, who is now on the pod with us. So, Laura, welcome aboard.
Thank you so much.
So I should say that what kind of precipitated this for me, other than my gravitational pull towards all author signings as soon as I see one is happening, is the fact that you are working in a genre that we've occasionally touched with our toe tips ever so slightly, but not very often, that is a kind of been titled by the marketing folks as romantasy. And so that's what you're kind of doing with the Renegade and the Lodestar. And so I'm wondering if you can catch our listeners up a little bit on the premise.
Okay. Yes. It's funny because I just heard the term romantasy like in the past year, and I didn't even realize that's kind of what I was doing. And I was more current than I expected. So that was exciting.
Yeah. See, there's this thing there. So there's lots of evils in the world. Okay. There's lots of evils in the world.
Yeah.
And I have personal experience with one of those evils. It's called marketing.
Mm.
And in marketing, everything has to be labeled.
Yes.
It has to be categorized.
Yeah.
And so that's why they have to come up with a label and a category, because otherwise, how do they explain what your book is?
Right.
It's impossible to understand with words who would do that. I have to make new words like romanticy.
Right.
Yeah, that's why we get if Star Wars had a child with Game of Thrones.
Game of Stars.
What? Like what? What?
Yeah. So, but we digress. So.
Yeah, so let's see. So what I've done is it's a retelling of the Hades and Persephone myth. And I was inspired forever ago. My husband and I were watching the show Deadwood. Do you remember that show on HBO?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So this was back when Netflix, they would send you the DVD in the mail.
Oh, yeah.
So this was a while ago. And we were watching that show. And I've always just been a fan of Greek myth just since I was a kid. I think since Clash of the Titans, to be honest, which I feel like you both have probably seen.
Oh, yeah.
So I just was fascinated with Greek myth. I always just loved it. And then we were watching Deadwood, and I was watching Timothy Olyphant play that the marshal, and he was walking down the streets of this Wild West town, right? Totally, you know, crazy and wild and no law. And I just, he was in black, and the way he walked, and he was very straight backed and, but languid at the same time. And I just thought, I feel like he's like Hades. And if I imagine Hades, if the underworld was like the Wild West, that was totally untamed, and that Hades was someone who was trying to bring, was more in line with bringing justice to people who came down into the underworld. And so I just thought, huh, I feel like he was like Hades. And then I thought, well, if he's Hades, then you have to redo the whole story of Hades and Persephone. Because then, right?
You have to change. Yeah, as one does.
Yep, change the whole thing. And so that's kind of the inspiration. So it's just a retelling and just changing it into a love story, which, as it turns out, I'm a big fan of love stories, you know, big fan of classic literature, English major in college. And it turns out, leaving all those classics, being a Jane Austen fan for lots of reasons, one of the reasons is the love story at the end. So I never realized I was such a big fan of, it's weird, I don't want to call it romance, but it is a romance. So it's a romance and fantasy. So that's the inspiration. That's where it came from. And yeah.
You know, I never saw Deadwood first. I didn't see Deadwood first. Yeah. I saw Justified.
Oh, right. Oh, same idea. So similar character. Yes.
Yeah. And so back in the day on the podcast, this is pre-Tracy, I would talk to my former co-host, Anelio, and I would say, you know, I love Justified, and I never really liked Timothy Olyphant before, but I really like him in this role as like this cowboy. And he's like, oh, well, Patrick, then you need to go watch Deadwood. You know, and it's like, oh, okay. And then I started watching Deadwood, and that's kind of how, yeah.
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 That's great. Yeah. Oregano's. Oregano's Pizza Bistro.
All right, done.
Oh, okay. So to catch the listeners who are now very baffled up,
who know that I get so focused on things that I can't let it go.
No, you found it. You found it. Dog with a bone, except dog with a pizza this time.
Yes,
dog with a pizza. Which is like even happier than with a bone.
And I was so sure it was a G and it was an O. So.
It's always kind of interesting how bits and pieces of things that happened in Green Room suddenly like manifest in the actual pod itself. So right now you're living in the Southwest out in Arizona, Laura. And so your access to all things Chicago and Midwest is, you know, more Southwesty, as it were. And there was a conversation about pizza and about where the good stuff can be got. And so Patrick had to do his homework.
That's the tavern style Chicago pizza is at Oregano's. Okay. And last time I checked, they were both in Phoenix area and they were also in Sedona area. So, but that's where I went and I got a wonderful pizza. So now,
okay.
I can relax.
Yes. Your spirit is released. You can now finally, you can go to a more peaceful version
I have done this podcast for so many years, Laura. It's not even funny. And I have attempted to explain to all the different people how my brain works and how someone will say something. And I just get so stuck on it forever. Mm. And this is one of those things. It's like, oh my God, I cannot remember the name of this. Why can't I remember the name of this? And then I just have to do it. But yeah. So by the way, Timothy Olyphant said that, and he even said this in the interviews about Justified, that you know, he was Gary Cooper.
Oh,
he was doing Gary Cooper, you know, and everybody always saw him as Gary Cooper.
See that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I can see that. I like it.
So I think we've had a lot of authors on who have touched on mythology, particularly Greek mythology, for various like strategies for retelling. But the fact that you have this kind of Wild West tilt to it is sort of new territory, at least for me. And so I'm kind of wondering for you, what does a Wild West vision of – what is it about the Wild West that feels to you particularly suited to the underworld?
It's funny. We've moved a few places since we moved out of the Midwest. We were in Oregon for a bit. That's just where I started this. And then we moved to Southern California and then I kept writing. And then we would take trips here to Arizona. And we did this really long drive from Southern California. Then we went to Phoenix and then we did a big long trip to the Four Corners. So we drove through, which is so cool. We drove through parts of New Mexico and then big parts of, you know, this part of Arizona. And it was when I was, I already had the idea of kind of the underworld being like the Wild West. But my only vision of the Wild West was from like Deadwood and movies and stuff. But then when we were, did that drive and I saw parts of New Mexico with like the big mesas and then like the completely flat plains, almost like you're still in central Illinois, and then the big cactus. And I just sort of created this, like I had this idea of just kind of like almost like sort of like the Saguaros, but there's a certain scene where like the Saguaro would be like Saguaros, they all get burned out and kind of black, and so you still have these sort of like things like creeping up from the ground, sort of like they want to hold on to you, like the cactus but all burned out, and then just that idea of like the space and then like the big flat rock formations, and so it just kind of like became a combination of those two things.
Yeah, there's an intensity to the aesthetic that I think lends itself pretty well.
Yes. It's sort of stark and sort of like we joke around, like if you're, when you go out in the desert, like everything wants to kill you, you know, like, you're like the bugs and the plants. And, you know, we did this tour, we first moved here and they're like, every plant like wants to kill you. So like that sort of danger of just being out in the world here, it's sort of like, just don't be careful. And my husband, we first moved here, he's like, don't walk on the rocks because like things could crawl out. And so you're just like, oh my gosh, like it feels, it doesn't feel that way now, but when you first moved here, everything sort of felt fraught with like peril. I think that too.
Which I guess thinking about it, that kind of takes me to the idea of the OG Hades and Persephone myth is this kind of unlikely love story between this incarnation of growth and spring and, you know, the Lord of the underworld and the idea that, you know, the underworld could be this intimidating, fraught environment, like you're just describing there, until you're accustomed to it. Like that there's a process of habituation that makes it possible to feel safe, to feel loved, to, you know, feel connected. And that sort of process of habituation to the space is kind of like the process of habituation in a relationship. And so it seems like there's this kind of like cool potential synergy there between how the environment and the people in it have to adjust to each other.
Oh, I love that. That's so true. Oh, I love that. I never thought about it that way, but I love it. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So new blurb. There you go.
I know. I love that. It's wonderful.
It's almost like acclimating to an environment. To your point about Arizona, you acclimate. Yeah. Like I went to, I went there from Colorado for a trip, and having grown up in California, I was acclimated to California, but then eventually, you know, get to Colorado. Now I'm acclimated to Colorado. I go to Arizona and I just want to die. I just want to die. Like if Arizona is trying to kill you, like I would have let it, because, you know, I'm sitting there at 7 o'clock at night and I'm going, why am I still sweating?
Also, it's light out.
Yeah. it gets really light in the summertime. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really light very, very early too. So, it's bright. Yeah. It is so true. You have to, everywhere you move, you have to, these things you have to adjust to.
Yeah. And now it's like, it's 16 degrees in Colorado and, you know, I go outside wearing a t-shirt, a hoodie and my PJs. And I'm just like, oh yeah. Oh, it's cold. Huh? Yeah, I guess it got colder overnight, you know, and then come back in and my dog's like, hey, I want to spend the entire day in the backyard. I'm like, it's probably not a good idea for you to do that right now, because my brain is telling me that it's really, really cold, even though my body's like, yeah, let's hang out.
Yeah.
Right. Or like when I used to live in Chicago, those spring days where it's 30, but you feel like you're going out in your t-shirt and your shorts because you're like, oh my gosh, it's so warm. But here, if it's 30, you'll be like, I've put my boots on and my winter coat.
Yeah. There's the viral images of people, usually dudes, guys in Denver when it snows going out in their, you know, Birkenstocks and shorts, shoveling snow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Now, the official South Side of Chicago shoveling your snow outfit for most dudes is like a pair of like legit snow boots, but then like jorts.
Yeah.
On the
South Side of Chicago?
Shit, yeah.
In the baddest part of town?
Yeah.
I knew a guy who lived there. His name was Leroy Brown.
Yeah. I'm waiting for you to bust out the guitar. Bad. So
Leroy Brown.
Yeah, I'm with you. I got it. God. Oh my gosh. So, okay. You've got a lot of kind of inspirational irons in the fire here. That kind of makes me wonder, like, okay, dream it up with me, Laura, but who do you think is your ideal reader? Like, obviously you should write for yourself because you're always your first reader, but like, now that the book is out here in the world where other people can have it, who do you think is the person you most want to lay their hands on this book?
That is such a good question. Gosh,
that's why we keep her on the payroll.
That's true. Yeah, they pay me the big bucks.
Oh, wow. I think what I get most excited about, I think there are the readers who already are familiar with mythology. So I almost want to kind of have two different ideal readers. The first one would be people who are familiar with mythology, Greek mythology, and the story of Hades and Persephone. And they see all the different little things that I put in there about things, the way I changed so many things about, like, you know, Zeus, just everything. So all the different little things that I've changed, like, oh, that's interesting. Or the muses, like where the muses came from, and the harpies and that kind of thing. And then the other, I think, the other readers that I hope to attract would be people, and I've had a lot of people say this, they don't know anything about Greek mythology, and that they pick it up because they're looking for a love story, and then they're kind of brought into this world that they never knew about, and they can kind of get then excited about Greek myths, and then kind of go from there and see all the great things that all the great other things and a great art that's been inspired by mythology. So I think
the gateway drug reader.
Yes. <Yeah. laughs> Exactly. Clash of the Titans was for me as a kid. Like that little mechanical gold owl of Athena. I just think that stuck with me. And I was like, this is amazing. And my parents bought me Greek mythology books. I thought they bought them for me because they just thought I'd like them. But my mom said I asked for them back in, I don't remember how young I was. And I still have them, these little, it just captured me. So kind of want that for, a couple different kinds of readers, ideal readers, I think.
So Tracy always prepares for these things with a bunch of questions that she writes down. I'm gonna steal one potentially from her list because this is something she's asked before. Was there like a specific translation that you used as like a source material? Like, was it Bullfinch? Was it something else? Like,
that's a great question. I think I combined them. So I have Bullfinch and then Edith Wharton. So I think those both were the big things that, and I have another really big Greek myth project that this was sort of like the little baby offshoot of that project got so big. I had to be like, I need to step aside and do like a simple, smaller story. So yes, Bullfinches and Edith, not Edith Wharton, Edith something. I can't remember. I have it in the other room, but Bullfinch was a big one. And then Edith, and I apologize, I can't remember her name. That would be the other one as well, would be the big ones. And then I took, when we were in California, I took some classes at UCI, some Greek, I started taking ancient Greek. Really, it was really hard. So I didn't go too far with that, but it was an amazing experience. And then I took classes from her name is Professor Andromache Karanaki, I think. And she did, I think it was like a class about kind of Greek ritual and culture. And so she talked a little bit about the Hades and Persephone myth in that class. And what I really liked about that class, it also stuck with me that I wrote a little bit about it in the afterword, is when she talks about this is probably 10 years ago at that time, current scholarship. A lot of scholars think that the Hades and Persephone myth was incorporated with the Eleusinian mysteries. So the rituals that happened, I can't remember again, apologize. I think it's once a year where the myth is associated with the ritual and it's about transitions in life. So for example, like when a woman gets married, and how after you go through an experience, nothing is ever the same after that. So I kind of wound that into it as well. And when she taught that, I thought, that's amazing. You're having this, right? You're moving to a different place, right? You're not the same person that you were after you went to Arizona and it was like 120 degrees still at 7 o'clock at night. That changed you in some way. And then you don't go back to being the same person. So that was, she was a big influence in that whole concept and idea. Influenced the book for sure, and the way I told the story, I think.
Tracy, yeah. I can't imagine taking a Greek class, like a class to learn Greek. I think it would be so distracting and disruptive that every time someone got an A, everybody shouts, "Opa!" and throws their books on the floor.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like everything just breaks, pouring olive oil on everything. This is definitely the way it would go. Those are the rules.
Exactly.
Oh, my gosh. You know, I think there's so many different mythologies out there that I remember getting kind of obsessed with as a kid. Definitely. I think it's like the bog standard experience of American education to like somewhere in elementary school. They're like, and now the myths, and like you get the Greek stuff, and then maybe they show you some Roman stuff and you're like, wait a minute. And they're like, yeah, the Romans were just plagiarists. We get it. Mm-hmm. They really were. They were kind of like the world's most successful plagiarists. If you think of it, they just kind of like, oh, we're going to take your governance system and we're going to take your this and that. And now we're going to make an empire.
Yanis is very angry with you right now.
Yeah. Well, I don't care. Yeah. So and there's, you know, you get some Native American mythology and you have like various tall tales and mm-hmm. and all sorts of things. If you had the opportunity to kind of dip your I mean, and you do because you're an author, mm-hmm. to dip yourself back into the world of mythology, but not Greek, mm-hmm. where do you think you might go?
Ooh, another fun question. I couple places. Egyptian mythology. Mm. Is also intriguing and so different, so vastly different. And then also I'm interested. So I've always wanted to write a book that was inspired something about my grandmother. So my father's mother who lived in Chicago, born and raised in Chicago, and she was a dancer and just all kinds of great stuff. And I always had the idea of incorporating some Celtic mythology with that. Okay. And Celtic mythology is harder to grasp. it's less I don't want to say linear is not the right word, but it's challenging. So I think I would say Egyptian, which I think mm-hmm. is fascinating, and then probably I'm trying to get into Celtic, and you just need to
spend a few hundred years in Tir na n'Og, and then it'll be fine.
Yeah,
that'd be good.
You'll figure it out.
Yeah. Sounds good.
I sort of feel like Celtic mythology is like the one of the last great cultural middle fingers towards the British hegemony, to be sort of like, oh yeah, well, we're going to tell stories that not a lot of you can understand, like not a one of you. And be like, Cúchulainn, is he a dog sometimes? Is he a person also sometimes? Like, does his name literally mean dog? Yes. Like, what's going on with like Boudica or something over here? Wait, that's pronounced Boudica? Yes. Mm-hmm. It's a lot. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So that'll be a tough one. Yeah, exactly. I think that's perfect. That's
Egyptian mythology is super metal too. Like, I mean, we talk a lot about different underworlds and afterlives and so on, but the whole idea of be like, okay, here's your whole heart. We're going to weigh it against a feather. Hope you don't have any unresolved traumas or burdens. Oh my gosh. Like the Sobek, Devourer of Souls, would make an entire feast of the 21st century of America here. Like, not a one of us, man. Hearts.
You could take Egyptian mythology and almost create 9 seasons of a science fiction show wrapped around that.
You could, and there'd be gates, and they'd be in Colorado.
Yeah. I do want to point out that as soon as you guys started talking about Celtic mythology, my dog, who is named Ronan after someone in Celtic mythology, immediately started barking downstairs. So he felt the disturbance in the force. Yes.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. He understood the assignment, as they say.
I was always surprised, Tracy, that you mentioned elementary school. Like I went to parochial school, as we know, Catholic school. Mm-hmm. They taught Bullfinch's mythology and they taught Egyptian mythology. And I always thought that was, like, I didn't think about it at the time. At the time, I was like, this is really cool. But then later on, I'm like, huh.
I don't know that Catholic parochial schools worry too much about losing folks to the pagan ways of the ancient Egyptians. Like, I don't think that.
So you're saying that they never watched young Sherlock Holmes?
Evidently, no. No. Okay. Yeah. That's and I didn't either, so that went right over my head, kid. Mm. Like, I got
the
I got
main the idea. Main protagonist enemies in young Sherlock Holmes are worshippers of, was it Sutek? And Egyptian, and so there's a, it turns out there's like an Egyptian cult operating at the boarding school that he's been sent to, where he
that's very like that's very Victoriana friendly though,
exactly.
Because they went through their own kind of like pseudo orientalist obsessive thing.
And they have like Britain. They've like built a pyramid inside of some buildings so that like if you go in the buildings, like there's just like a, it's just like a facade now, and inside these buildings is an actual pyramid. And yeah,
which they named Las Vegas.
So we do have like it's really... actually a really good movie, believe it or not. Young Sherlock Holmes. I loved that movie as a kid. I thought it was so good. And he's like a teenager kind of ish.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they set up the entire thing for young for Sherlock Holmes. Like he meets John Watson as another student who's younger than him.
Okay.
And I believe he meets the woman, you know, and stuff like that. And so they're like they build that all up. And by the way, since we're talking about it now, because you've got me on a rant.
It's my fault.
There will be a TV show that's not based on that movie, but I think it's Guy Ritchie and it's young Sherlock Holmes. I think it's coming to Netflix.
Oh.
Guy Ritchie's really got his claws into the whole Holmesian thing, doesn't he?
Yeah.
No more.
I just remember in that movie, there's this great scene where Watson is like, he eats a lot. Young Watson is into pastries and sneaking pastries and eating them. And at some point he gets pricked with like an Egyptian needle that has some sort of hallucinogenic properties in the stuff that's on the needle. And the pastries start animating and come to life to attack him. Yeah, it's all good stuff. It was a great little movie.
Some
it was
Alice
a great
in Wonderland
movie.
Shit going on there.
I always wanted there to be a sequel to that movie. And Robert right now is going, yes, yes, there should have been a sequel to that movie. That's one of our patrons and listeners.
That's good. That's good. It's like we need to do some fan servicing for Robert. Yeah. So
it was such a great movie.
On the subject though of like Americans having odd relationships to mythology, I imagine the answer is yes for you, Patrick, but I don't know for you, Laura. Are you aware of the fact that outside of Nashville, Tennessee is an actual scale replica of the Parthenon?
Yes.
Like I've been there. It was a long time ago. I went there like 20 years ago, a little more, as part of a family trip that my husband's family was on. And it was just the weirdest goddamn thing to be wanting to like, and I kept thinking to myself, why? Why here? What? But why? I mean, it's not that it isn't cool, but it's very why.
I think the question you need to ask yourself is why not?
Evidently.
You can, why not? I've always talked about the fact that the J. Paul Getty Museum in Los Angeles is actually a replica of a Roman villa from, I believe, from Herculaneum.
Yeah, that's like, gorgeous.
And it is. And it's like up on the hill and you know, as you're standing on the balcony, looking down at the garden with the pools and stuff, and you're looking out at the ocean. Oh my God. Again, why not?
Yeah, it's spectacular. Yes, we were in Nashville. My son had a hockey tournament a couple years ago and our hotel. And because my husband knows me, he's like, we got the hotel where you can see the Parthenon from the hotel. And I was like, what? But yeah, I think it was like the World's Fair or like one of those things. I think they built it for a fair, one of those fairs, and they kept it. And it's just, I know it's so random and it is so cool to go inside and you see a Athena statue and they have it painted. Like they think it would be painted with the gold and the.
Yeah.
Yes.
So and it's kind of it requires this weird mental reframing because there's a plaque there that explains that archaeological evidence suggests that a statue of Athena in the actual Parthenon in Greece was in fact painted at some point and that paint is just long since worn away.
Yeah.
And so they've attempted to paint it in what they believe is a faithful replication of it. But there's this like cognitive dissonance of I'm looking at a Parthenon that's like, and the Athena is painted up. Like she headed to the club, this Athena, like she's, She's very like gold inlay. This is Athena by way of Beyonce. And so it's very weird.
Yeah, it does. You do have to think about it, because you're like, well, it's not what you expect. You expect the just plain marble with nothing. Yeah, that's so funny. It's so true. Yeah.
And I like to believe that there was an episode of The Simpsons where they go to Knoxville and they see this tower with the giant ball on it on the top. And they say it's like from a World's Fair. And when I moved to Knoxville for a little while, I saw that tower and I was like, oh, cool. They watched The Simpsons episode and built that tower.
Oh, bless. Never change, Patrick. All right, so I'm going to take a wild – usually I try and do like a segue of some kind.
I got something else for you. So you mentioned being in your son's college town.
Yeah.
And that's where you met Laura.
It is.
She was doing the book signing. I do have one more Knoxville story, which is I moved there from California. I have no friends. I have no life. The job that I had at the time was like, don't get chummy with the people that you're working with, because they were essentially, I could go into their businesses at any time and go, oh, by the way, we're seizing your entire inventory and these chains are for your warehouse. And you don't want them to then go, I'm going to kill you. So my cousin and his wife come to town and they're like visiting because they're about to move to Chattanooga. And they're like, show us the town. I'm like, okay, I will show you the town that I've never visited and done anything in before. So we get in my car and we're driving through downtown Knoxville. Mm-hmm. And if you don't already know this, downtown Knoxville is essentially the University of Knoxville.
Yeah.
Like that's all it is. And this is Peyton Manning era, like of the Tennessee Volunteers. And so we're in my car. The windows are down. We're doing 15 mile an hour as we're going down the middle of the street, you know, downtown, because that's the speed limit. And everywhere is orange and white. It looks like a creamsicle or sherbet, right?
Yeah.
And as we're kind of going and my cousin and I are talking, and all of a sudden in the back seat, his wife goes, oh, my God, what's with all this god awful orange?
And that's when somebody sniped out your tires.
And that's when I slunk down like to look like an old person in Arizona driving with the steering wheel well above my head and going, oh, my God, just please let us survive this. Please, please, please don't let them kill us. So there's my college town story.
The vibe on that in Jacksonville, Illinois is not the same. I don't know that the furor surrounding the Blue Boys is quite as powerful for the Volunteers. Okay, so I promised like a swerve, and so yeah. I have a swerve here, as it were.
Wasn't swerve like a brand of hair shampoo products from the 80s?
Probably.
And
90s? It's also like there's an AEW wrestler, Swerve Strickland, but that's a different swerve as well than the one I'm talking about here. So one of the things that is part of your creative endeavors, Laura, is that you make jewelry. I'm going to pose a thesis to you, and I want to see if this is something that you would get behind. Okay. Making jewelry is stringing one thing after another, and so is writing. Agree, disagree, defend, analyze.
Ooh, I think I would agree. I think there are definite similarities as you're have an idea of what the end product is going to be, and then you put one piece together at a time, and as you make it, going to make there will changes as you go. So I would say I would agree. And I think I read Steinbeck wrote I'm sure you know it, like a really small book about his writing process or kind of like his experience with writing. And one of the things he said in that was he liked to also be doing something with his hands, like making something concrete. And I remember I was already making jewelry at the time and I was like, oh, it's kind of like the same idea where when you're writing, you're making something, of course, it's eventually becomes a, you know, hopefully something you hold or people hold. But when you make something like jewelry or like Kinky was like a woodworker or something, then you're making something that you can actually, people can touch and you're making something physically with your hands. So the process is so similar, but different. I like that. That's interesting.
To keep playing with that theme, have you ever taken a soldering iron to your writing?
Metaphorically speaking.
To bring things together, kind of. Maybe. That's a thing about that.
Really need this chapter to fit in here somehow.
Like, huh, maybe.
Yeah. I've had moments that felt like that in writing. So I'd say, yeah, kind of. Maybe even more than metaphorically. Right. Maybe before we get ourselves into some more trouble, it's a good time for picks of the week.
Hey, everybody, Patrick here. And before we get to picks of the week, I wanted to take a moment to thank you for listening and talk about a couple of ways you can help support the pod. First off, if you're subscribed via Apple Podcasts or Spotify, simply downloading new episodes each week helps with the algorithm. Those nasty algorithms. If you're doing that on one platform, thank you. But could you consider doing it on the other one as well? You don't have to double listen, but with how the podcast landscape has kind of fractured over the past few years, being subscribed and downloading the episodes each week on both platforms really helps us out. I don't think Google Podcasts exists anymore. I think I got like some emails about that. But if you're there, hey, you know what? That would help as well. Second, we have a Patreon over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. And some changes are coming there very, very soon. Starting in February, we are eliminating the $10 tier and moving all the perks from that tier to the $5 tier. That's right. The $5 tier will now include our exclusive monthly Just Us episodes for the patrons. Those are wildly popular, and we want to be able to open that up so more people can listen and enjoy those episodes. We're also going to add a new Discord server. It's currently in beta testing, and that'll give us a new place to chat and grow our community away from all the AI bots and things that Meta is doing with groups on their platform. But wait, there's more! That's right. We have even more stuff planned for our patrons in 2026 to thank them for their support. So, this is the best time to jump over to patreon.com/functionalnerds and back us at that $5 tier if you haven't already. You will get all the new goodies when they drop, because I'm not going to put a $10 tier back. It's all going to be right there on the $5 tier moving forward. Okay, I think that's it for me. So let's get back to picks of the week.
All right. So Patrick, other than soldering irons, what would you pick?
So I'm on the kick of Christmas presents. So Giles and Emily got me some minis. And this is for Pathfinder, and I didn't even know that this existed. These are little boxes of minis called Pathfinder Battles.
Oh.
And they're kind of sort of part of different adventures or adventure paths. So they got me one that's like Kingmaker, which is a very, very popular adventure path that they've done. It's even been converted into 5e because so many Dungeons & Dragons players want to play it. And then Maze of Death is the other one. And each one of these, the box comes with four minis that are pre-painted inside, but it's random. You don't know what you're going to get until you open it. There's like a whole set of them. And it's really, really cool. I will, for the benefit of the two of you, I will show you, like, these Ooh. Are some serious minis. Like, they're not...
Wow.
No,
he's like a samurai dude with a sword, and he's got like a spell thing going on with his hand.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The one that I did not understand was the swarm of bats.
Oh, because you've got to have all their wings are kind of linked to one another for support.
Yeah,
but it's a swarm if you're not looking closely, it just sort of looks some weird squamous structure.
And it's just all these different pre-painted minis. And they know that I can't paint to save my life.
Yeah, yeah.
So having pre-painted minis, this is like a spellcaster, and he's got They do the clear thing to show like magic energy is kind of going off them. Right. And it's just neat. So they got me two of those. So I've got 8 new minis to add to my minis collection. Nice. And I didn't even know these existed. It's from Paizo and from WizKids.
Okay.
Which WizKids can be hit or miss sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like WizKids, I think, is the one, I think, that did the Baldur's Gate 3 minis that turned out to be just horrific. They just looked so god awful that people were really pissed, and they ended up like recalling them all and saying they were going to do something else. But these are cool because there's like a set of like 100 or something for each one, and then you just get 4, and it's random 4 every time. So I thought that was kind of cool. And so if you're looking to just get minis for your gaming. Right. This is a nice way to just get a bunch of minis all at once. Get the Pathfinder battles, and then boom, you got some pre-painted minis, if I could speak. Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. I love that. So that would be very good for me because I absolutely cannot and do not paint, minis.
They're so tiny. My son just got into he's into Warhammer.
The
Warhammer store because he was interested in learning how to do the painting, and I am floored at how tiny those things are. They're so tiny.
So when are you selling your house to support that?
I know.
Yeah. R.I.P. budget.
He's thinking about it. And he wants to do it this summer. But yeah, I know. That the guy was super good, and he was telling him like, I would start very small and do. Saying it could become a real investment.
It becomes a very big investment. Yeah, that. I actually have a friend that I game with who started in the Warhammer stuff, and he's really, really good at painting stuff.
Yeah.
So he just painted a bunch of things for us, for me. Because I asked him to, but he doesn't like to paint anymore. Like it just became a thing. And he got out of the Warhammer stuff, and he's been playing D&D and other games now. But it can become really costly really quickly because you're just constantly buying armies to paint and then, do stuff with them. And
that's how I like.
There you go.
There's a Warhammer store, or it's like Legoland for Warhammer. It's in the UK.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they're bringing one to America. Like they're going to build one in America somewhere now.
I got to tell my son. He's very excited.
Yeah.
I'll bet. Yeah. We'll make a pilgrimage.
So then the other question is he dry painting or wet painting?
He hasn't done it yet, but the owner of the store was so great. He's like, he's got this area above where at the front where he gives you a freebie. They do. Yeah. And then he shows you. So he's going to take a friend.
The first one's free.
First, it's always free.
there's that gateway.
It's a warning thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Apparently there is a thing where you can you either dry brush or there's a thing where you have a wet palette where it's like you have a wet piece of paper or something. Mm-hmm. And then you keep that wet and then it lets you paint. And then no matter what I do, everything comes out looking like the Joker.
It's so small. Like I don't know. I mean, your fine motor skills would have to be incredible. And just
exactly.
It's kind of unforgiving.
The listeners can't see this, but every time I go to paint, it's like my hand comes up and then all of a sudden, you're shaky.
Yeah. All right. So Laura, how about you?
Okay. So I've been listening and I know that you don't do a ton of watching things, but this was on Netflix. It was a series and it was short. It was only 4 episodes, which I actually had never seen. I don't remember. I was like, is it 4? It's only 4. It's called Death by Lightning.
Oh yeah.
Oh, look at it. Oh my gosh. It's so interesting. So being from Central Illinois, big into Abraham Lincoln, big into history and stuff like that. So this was, it's the story of two presidents that I know almost nothing about. So James Garfield and then, Chester Arthur. And what's so good about it is, so Garfield was assassinated. It's kind of the story of his assassin as well, but it sounds so dark, but it's not, because the way they do it is it's a little bit funny and it's a little bit hopeful. And it's just, my husband and I were just, we just absolutely loved it. I love learning, things about characters in history or people in history that you don't know a lot about. But the way they did it, again, there was humor, and then there was real optimism, which sounds so odd, about Garfield's belief in who Chester Arthur was, that when he had to rise to the occasion to become, to step in to be president, he could do it. I just really, really liked it. Really liked it. Death by Lightning I thought it was really excellent. Just
that's
really
not the good. Second time that has been recommended, Tracy. So it's only four episodes. I think you're going to have to watch it.
Okay.
Yeah, and the female characters, back when this took place, women, of course, didn't have a ton of power, but they're so important and essential, and the things that they do are so important it's just so good. It's great.
It's a good sales pitch. All right.
Really
so, wow. Okay. So my pick is also a Christmas gift, somewhat similar to Patrick. And surprise, it's a board game. This is the most me-coded board game to have ever boarded a game, gamed a board, whatever. So it is not that okay, one of these days we'll do like screenshots. It's called A Place for All My Books. It is literally a game about putting your books in places, which you might say to yourself, like, that sounds terrible. I hate organizing stuff. Why would I want to do this? And so the mechanics of this game are like, you have an apartment. Every player, it's 1 to 5 players. Every player has an apartment, and the apartment has the same exact number of rooms for everybody. And you're given a deck of cards to work from. Your character's identity entitles you to a certain number of books, and those books will have different color covers. There's yellow ones, blue ones, red, green, whatever. And those suggest that they're different genres. Who knows what correlates to what? It doesn't matter. And so the idea is you get in this like deck of cards different things that you're trying to complete as missions that are called projects, and it has to do with like how to organize your books. Like you might have a project that's like, make sure you don't have any blue books in your bathroom, which why do you have books in your bathroom to begin with? But whatever. And so on.
You put
and
the
so,
shitty like, ones in there.
This guy. Like make sure you have at least 3 red books on your nightstand or things like this. And so you have a certain number of moves you can do every turn that allows you to like move your book assets around your little playboard. And when you complete your little missions, you get to take a reward for yourself. And 2 things happen. You complete your social battery. There's a meter that is your social battery that goes from sad face to happy face. And the more little projects around your house that are like cozy little you things you do, the more your social battery increases. And the rewards you get might be things like new hobby. And the new hobby cards will be things like knitting or like new teapot or like painting minis or like get a new board game and things. And they are like, I said, this is fucking me coded. Like, yeah. And so... And then once you've kind of topped out your social meter, now you can go to town. Going to town where you might see people drains your social meter. And every place you go in town, you can take different actions that are related to books or your hobbies. And you keep doing it in this loop that involves like collecting adorable objects or like, you know, like you got a cozy sweater and this increases your social battery by whatever. And it is delightful and cute, and one of the most fun parts about playing it with my daughter and my husband and a friend of mine was us getting like excited for each other's things. Like, oh, you got a teddy bear! Like, oh my gosh, you've got Gunpla! Your character's got Gunpla figurines! That's so cool! They can't call them Gunpla because branding, but whatever. And so it is a game. It does not take super long to play. It is a, let me check the box. It's about an hour long play. I'm sorry, it's 1 to 4 players. My bad, not 1 to 5. But it is so cozy. It is easy to understand. It has tons of replayability. There's lots of interesting game mechanics going on. And All board games like this, when you come down to it, are basically a spreadsheet, right? They're a spreadsheet with bits that you get to move around. But this is such an adorable spreadsheet, and it is so much fun. So you might see in some game stores A Place for All My Books and say to yourself, what on earth even is this? Just smash the buy button. Just get yourself this game.
I actually know a friend I'm going to buy that for literally when we're done talking.
It is lovely. Even with the teach is easy too. The teach was like 10 minutes and the gameplay was still only about an hour. So like, and we had four players and with a group that's very, very like optimizing the moves analysis paralysis. So I can say with certainty it is not more game than a lot of people could do. So, oh my goodness. This has been a journey, and what a fun one it is. So thanks so much for being with us, Laura. So can you brief us on what you're up to and where people can find you and more of your cool stuff?
Yes. So let's see. I'm currently editing my next book, which I'm away from the mythology world before I come back to it. This is going to be a book that's, again, a little bit of magic and a little bit of fantasy involved, but it also has to do with William Shakespeare, his wife Anne Hathaway, and Christopher Marlowe. And it's a story kind of about the three of them and writing plays together and their dialogue through the plays. So I'm giving Anne Hathaway a role in Shakespeare's writing. So that's coming. And then you can find me. So my website is, I've got the Renegade and the Lodestar.com. And then my other website is laurakmauer.com. And that will have a little bit of information about the upcoming book. And then the Scottsdale Book Festival is this weekend. If anyone is around, I guess actually this might not be out before.
This will be on after.
Anyway,
yeah.
Never mind. Forget it. Other than that.
But now you know she's the kind of person who will be at the Scottsdale Book Festival, which, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mark your 2027s, yes. Kids.
There you go. So yeah, that's it. And thank you so much. It's been so nice. It was so amazing that I just got to, that you weren't even supposed to be at the bookstore that day, but you came up to my little table and said hi, and it was just lovely. So nice.
Sometimes that's the best way for it to happen.
Yep. It's kismet.
Yes. Happened organically.
Thanks so much, Laura.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode or any of our episodes, please, please consider sharing it with your friends on social media and give us a like or some stars on the platform or the podcatcher that you're listening to us on. If you'd like to keep up with the Functional Nerds on social media, the official podcast socials are as follows. At the-functional-nerds on Facebook. At functionalnerds_podcast on Instagram. Shut up. I couldn't get the same one. It just didn't work that way. So hush. And you know what? It's going to get worse here. And at thefunctionalnerds.bluesky, which is BSKY, .social. I know, I couldn't keep it copacetic. I tried, but hush. Tracy and I have our own accounts. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. You can find us by searching, if you want me, it's ATFMB, because that's just my handle everywhere I go. Or you can search for Tracy Townsend and find Tracy on social as well. Our Patreon helps keep the lights on, and new episodes like this one coming out week after week, which we've been pretty good at. I mean, we're very consistent, so you might consider checking us out over at patreon.com/functionalnerds just to support the pod and help us out there, you know? It does help. Thanks again for listening. And I have one question for you before I go. Is it baseball season yet?
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake, Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, hey, I really love what you do, I'm like, I'm sorry. Do you know who I think you have me confused with someone else.
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.